Today is about 1:32 on January the 30th. Currently present are Representative Holmes, Representative Kawasaki, Guerra, Costello, Stoltz, Osterman, Wilson, Thompson, Edgman, and Newman. Today we will be taking up two more overviews in the governor's refunding request. And so we have the Department of Fish and Game today, and also the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. So, Commissioner, if you would like to join us at the table, we will get started on our overview. Representative Munoz is also here. As we have done in the last few overviews, Commissioner will make her presentation, and we will ask questions after she's done. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Cora Campbell, Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game, and with me at the table is Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks. Also in the audience is our Acting Director for Admin Services, Carol Petterborg, and our Division Director for Subsistence, Hazel Nelson, as well as our Legislative Liaison, Ben Mulligan. And I'd also note that Ben Brown, one of the commissioners for CFEC, is here as well. I want to start by apologizing to the co-chairs, who both sat through a very similar presentation in subcommittee. We'll try to spice it up for you a little bit, but we will be retreading some of the same ground. So I believe you have these handouts available to you. I included the mission statement of the department to start out with, and I just on the first slide, and I'd also note that on the second slide we've included the sections of the Constitution and Alaska statutes from which we draw our mission statement. I included a slide for you that talks about what our core services are. We have six, including harvest management, and we have some measures for that. We measure it by commercial harvest, the purchase of hunting fishing license, angler days, and user success. And we'll talk about that a little more after I get through the rest of the core services, but we just included some examples for you of the metrics that we use for that. The other core services are stock assessment, which we measure by whether or not we're meeting escapement goals and whether or not we're getting our wildlife surveys completed. Customer service, which we measure primarily through our angler skills-oriented programs, our programs for hunter heritage and wildlife education, and just overall providing information to the public. Public involvement, so making sure that Alaskans participate in the Board of Fish and Board of Game regulatory processes, and also involving the public in the decisions that are made by the department. State sovereignty is another one of our core services. We participate in federal land management planning processes, support the Department of Law in certain lawsuits. We've been very engaged in processes like Endangered Species Act listing decisions and the Federal Subsistence Board. And then lastly, but certainly not least, habitat protection. So we measure that by ensuring that developers are in compliance with permits that we issue through our habitat division. And we included this slide on harvest management just to give you an example of some of the metrics that we use to measure our performance with this core service. You can see that we've included sport fishing license, hunting and trapping licenses, and the value of commercial harvest as three of the metrics that we use to measure our progress towards this core service. Also included for you an organizational chart that shows that we have six divisions, one section, and two independent agencies that are attached to the department for administrative purposes. We included in your handout as well a map that shows where our offices are located throughout the state. You can see that we're fairly widespread. We have regional and area offices in many communities. What this map doesn't show is the many seasonal locations where we have field camps or a weir or some type of assessment project. So these are just the permanent offices. I'll just run through very quickly the different divisions, how we're structured. We have the commissioner's office. fairly small. It accounts for about 1% of the budget. We have three large divisions, management divisions, and those are commercial fisheries, sport fisheries, and wildlife conservation. Commercial fisheries is the largest. It accounts for about 34% of our annual operating budget, and it manages all the commercial fisheries as well as many of the personal use and subsistence fisheries that take place in state waters, and also is responsible for permitting of aquaculture and mariculture operations as well. Division of sport fish accounts for about 23% of the operating budget, manages the sport fisheries in the state, and operates the two sport fish hatcheries, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks, and has a responsibility for providing boater and angler access as well. Wildlife conservation is our third management division, and that's the division that is responsible for managing wildlife populations and hunter opportunity, and also runs three shooting ranges in the state and has a number of hunter education and safety programs. Subsistence division is a research division, and they're a smaller division. They account for about 4% of our annual budget, and they're responsible primarily for conducting research to document Alaskans' customary and traditional use of fish and wildlife resources and providing that information to decision makers, particularly in the Board of Fish and Board of Game arenas. Habitat division is primarily a permitting division. Again, it's a smaller division. It accounts for about 3% of the budget, but issues a substantial number of permits for activities in anadromous water bodies or other fish-bearing waters, and also in any legislatively designated special areas. We have an administrative services division that accounts for about 6% of the budget and conducts activities that are typical to admin services, accounting, budget, procurement, HR, those types of things. And then we also have one section, and that's the board support section. This is a small section. It accounts for about 1% of the budget, but they are primarily tasked with providing logistical support to the Board of Fish and Board of Game processes.
I asked a whole series of questions in subcommittee, and I'm sure you're feverishly working on responses. I won't ask them again unless it's necessary to remind you. Is my original assessment correct?
You're correct, Mr. Co-Chair. We are working on responses to the questions you raised, and we'll have those to you shortly.
We have a 90-day session and a much more compressed budget process. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll save the committee's time by not asking them again.
Okay, so the next slide lists the independent agencies that are attached to the department for administrative purposes, and that's the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. I've included some overview graphs here just to give you a sense of, as we talked about, what percentage of our budget each division accounts for. And you can see that, as I mentioned as we went through the slides, that the three large management divisions account for the bulk of the budget, and then the smaller divisions make up a smaller portion of our annual spending. There's also a graph here that shows where our budget is by fund source, and our primary fund sources are general fund, federal funds, and fish and game fund, and then there are a variety of smaller funding sources. We included some information on the positions that we have in the budget in FY14, 933 full-time, and then 1,719 total. And you can see from this that we do have a large number of seasonal and part-time employees because of the nature of our field season and the work. Not all the work that we do is year-round. We've also included some graphs here that are prepared by Ledge Finance, and Kevin Brooks is prepared to walk you through those.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for Fish and Game. The next four slides that you see are prepared by Ledge Finance, ones that you are probably familiar with from some of the other presentations. First one is a bar chart showing general fund growth for the department from 05 through the 14 request. And the budget has increased from 38 to 88, so about $50 million during that time. It still holds steady at about 1.7% of the total, share of this, of the total budget. And the growth we've looked at is attributable to three primary areas. About half of that growth is tied to contractual increases due to salaries that are negotiated with collective bargaining units, health insurance increases, and those sorts of things in the 100 line. So really just paying for what we have. It's not additional staff, but it's paying for staff that, that is already in the department. The other half of that growth is we distinguish that between initiatives that were requested by the governor at about 29%, and then also initiatives that were added by the legislature, and those totaled about 16% of that growth. The next slide shows the relative share of funding sources in the department's budget. As the commissioner pointed out, we're currently at about $215 million in our 14 requests. But noteworthy on this graph really is that while our federal funds have increased slightly in dollar amount, their share of our overall budget has dropped from about 40% to 30%. At the same time, the general fund has grown as a percentage from about 20% to close to 40%. Some of that, as we've drilled down and we've talked to the, as we get into the subcommittee process, we've seen that two of our divisions, Sport, Fish, and Wildlife Conservation, historically never received any general funds, but over the last decade, they have seen some increases. And so I think in Sport, Fish, out of a $50 million budget, they have about $7 million in GF. And for Wildlife, it's about a $45 million budget with a similar amount of general funds. And that's something that is new in, during this past decade. It's partly attributable to some of that general fund growth. The next graph is a line chart, projects the last 10 years and then takes that growth rate out over the last 10 years, projects it to the next 10 years. That's the upper line that's in green. And the lower line is based on the department's assessment of what we think the increases will be. And what we've used is an inflation rate of 2.75% on our non-personal services. And this is really the biggest distinction, and I think you've probably heard this in other departments, is the graph that, or the projection that we're placing does not include any estimated growth on personal services because future COLAs and things like that are unknown to us, and so they're not included. And from what we've seen in the past, that really does represent a large part of the growth that we've seen. And so it would probably most appropriately be done at a statewide level, but it's not in this graph. But we did use 2.75 on non-GF. We also estimated that we could have up to $1 million per year over the next 3 years in lost federal funds that we would need to at least ask for replacement. When we've done that with some thought, there's plenty of projects that we have and with federal funds that we start and stop those. They're very finite projects, and we end them when the money's gone. But there are some core functions in the department that are supported by federal funds. And in fact, one of our requests in the 14 budget requests a replacement of some federal funds that are going away, but it's tied to a very core management project that we have. And so we're asking for consideration there. And finally, because we did see initiatives over the last 10 years, I pointed out we had both governor initiatives and legislative initiatives added to the budget. We estimated 2% of our general fund, so we have about $80 million in general fund, and we figured $1.6 million as potential growth, and that is represented in our growth line. It doesn't mean we're going to get it. We just wanted to put it in there because past history indicated that whether it's the governor asking or there's projects that the legislature's interested in, there seem to be some money for specific projects, and so we wanted to do a fair estimation of that and include it for a 10-year plan. The next graph takes the same chart and uses all funds instead of just general funds, and I guess noteworthy there is that there's a much tighter convergence on those two lines.
So, Mr. Chair, what we move into now is a discussion of some of the things the department accomplished in 2012, and I bring these to your attention specifically because they're some of the things that we've requested funding for in the past, and so wanted to give you an update on those projects. The first thing that I'd note is some improvements that we've made to the information that's available as a result of our salmon research programs, most notably completion of the Western Alaska Salmon Stock ID program, which is something that the state invested in. It's the largest genetic stock ID program that we've ever undertaken, and that's complete now, and there are 9 different reports that resulted that are being used by the Board of Fish this cycle in their decision-making process. And there are other projects, too, in other regions where we've improved our salmon research program, but that's probably the largest that we completed this past year. Also want to note that one thing that the legislature has supported in the past and specifically provided funding for is the department's intensive management programs. We're currently implementing that in a number of different game management units, and we've seen increases in caribou and moose populations that are available for harvest as a result of these programs. So this is an effort that I think is really bearing fruit for Alaskans in terms of additional hunting opportunity that we're able to provide. And we continue through the Board of Game process to review these programs on a regular basis and make sure that they're providing the results that we want or being refined as necessary. I wanted to note as well that last year in the budget, there was an increment provided to assist Subsistence Division. One of the things that we noted is that Subsistence Division was was dealing in some cases with data that was decades old on customary and traditional harvests. And so we are addressing that in a number of different ways. One is that we're cooperating with DOT or DNR when there's a development project or a road proposed that requires subsistence data for permitting decisions. We're making sure that Subsistence Division is involved in that early on, and that has the dual benefit of updating our databases for use by the Board of Fish and the Board of Game in determining amounts necessary for subsistence and making management decisions, but also benefiting and expediting the permitting process for some of these development projects. So we appreciate the support on that, and the division has made real progress in surveying a number of communities that hadn't been surveyed in many, many years. We also brought to the legislature's attention in the past the need for some additional funds for Habitat Division in order to keep up with the number of permit requests that are coming through the door, and for some of these larger projects really to be involved early on in the pre-permitting design phase to help address some of the issues that we have up front and really make the process smoother later on. And so that's something that they've been able to keep up with the demand, to be able to keep their permitting process current and not have a backlog. So that's something that we think is going fairly well. And I also just want to note that we do have both the Fairbanks and Anchorage sport fish hatcheries up and running, producing fish. We're stocking those into lakes and streams and providing angler opportunity at the historic levels that we were at before we lost the ability to have heat from the old Elmendorf facility. So we're really happy with the improvements that we've seen in the size and the quality of fish that are being produced in those hatcheries. Moving on a little bit to talk about some of the current issues that we're facing and some of the things that you'll see addressed in our FY14 budget request. The biggest one that I wanted to make sure that we talked about is Chinook salmon abundance and productivity. I think everybody here certainly heard from constituents and is aware of the the great hardship that was caused throughout Alaska this summer as a result of low Chinook returns and the restrictions that had to be made to subsistence, sport, commercial, and personal use fisheries to ensure that we got our escapement goals where we could. And in response to that, the department has spent considerable time and resources developing a Chinook salmon research plan, and it's something that's included in our capital budget request for FY14 is a request for consideration of funds to implement that plan. But the plan includes it targets 12 indicator stocks throughout the state, and it includes juvenile work and adult work on those stocks, as well as increased coded wire tagging, genetics work, and biometric support in order to increase the knowledge that's available to the department about the causes of the low abundance that we've seen in Chinook salmon productivity across the state. And so that's our biggest capital request this year, and one of our largest priorities is to try to ensure that our research program is as robust and comprehensive as it should be for this to address this situation. I've also noted for you here increased fishing and economic opportunities, and really what we're talking about there is closely related to the third item, reductions in salmon management tools. And really what we've seen is that as we've had to absorb cost increases or there have been inflationary pressures, there may be places where the department doesn't have the resources to do as complete a stock assessment as we'd like, and that can at times lead to more conservative management and a loss of opportunity. So what we've been looking for is places where a small investment of state dollars could result in a large increase in opportunity for Alaskans. And so we brought there were a couple of those that were brought up last year either through the governor's request or through the legislative process that are in the water this year and providing some of that opportunity. But you'll also see in our 14 budget requests that we've identified some places specifically in our salmon fisheries where we feel that an injection of additional resources would help increase our understanding of how much salmon is available to harvest and our ability to provide some opportunity. We noted here also one of our big issues, which is the continual need that we have to spend time and resources protecting our state authority to manage fish and wildlife, and just the number of Endangered Species Act issues that we're dealing with and the staff resources that it takes to engage in all of those processes. We received some funding support in the past that is targeted at helping us increase the amount of research that we're doing on stocks that we know are a candidate for an eventual Endangered Species Act listing, so that when that comes up, we're as prepared as possible to bring state science to the table to inform that decision making. And we engage and work really closely on those issues with Department of Law. And Department of Law has had a couple of recent successes on Endangered Species Act issues, but we still see we still have tremendous concern about this. We still see a trend out there in federal agencies where they're listing species based on they're listing species that are healthy, they're stable, there are no threats in the immediate future, but if you project far out into the future and speculate about climate impacts, then that's what they're using to come to a listing decision. And that's really a different pattern than we've seen in the past, and one that causes us a lot of concern, because if you're listing species that are healthy with stable populations based solely on speculation about what could happen decades in the future, that's not a very high bar for coming to a listing decision and in some cases asserting federal control over a species that the state had managed or over lands that might be designated as critical habitat. And so that's something that we spend a lot of time on. Invasive species is another issue that we've been spending more time on lately. We have a couple of examples of invasives that we have active programs to try to suppress or eradicate. the tunicate that was found in Whiting Harbor near Sitka is one example. The invasive pike that are in some areas of South Central is another. And also just recognizing that while we do have some invasive species issues, Alaska is really fairly fortunate compared to other states in the number of species that we're dealing with. So really trying to shore up the prevention end of that effort rather than just reacting once a species is detected. Another issue that I'd note here is the need that we have for licensing modernization. And this is something else that you'll see reflected in our capital budget request for FY14. We have a licensing system that's fairly antiquated. We sell about 700,000 hunting, fishing, and trapping licenses each year, and it's largely a paper system, in some cases a carbon paper system. And all the reporting from the vendors is paper reporting, and there's a tremendous amount of data entry that goes along with that. And so we really feel like it's time to bring that into modern times and develop some of the tools that constituents have been asking for, like online reporting for personal use harvests or electronic logbooks or those types of things that the folks that we service with this would really like to see. The next slide is some of the highlights in our operating budget request for 2014. And there are a couple of themes as you look at these projects. One is, as Kevin indicated earlier, we've had to react in many cases to shifts in availability of federal funds. And we have a test that we apply internally when we're having to do that. If the federal funds are going away, we look carefully at the project that's being funded and determine whether it's really part of the core mission of the department and something that we should be spending state dollars on. And in some cases, we do have core services that are federally funded. And one example of that is that in Southeast Alaska, our salmon management programs rely rather heavily on federal funds. Some of those funds are no longer available. So one of the requests that you'll see from the department this year is for general funds to replace where we can no longer access federal funding for those Southeast salmon projects. We've noticed also a trend in recent years where there is pressure on the budget for the Division of Sport Fish. Sport Fish Division relies a lot on federal funding and income from license sales. Non-resident license sales have decreased a bit in recent years, although we're starting to see that trend flatten out, I think related probably to some signs of economic recovery in the lower 48. But that's what that division relies on for funding, and so both a reduction in federal funds and a reduction in those funds have kind of put the squeeze on that division. And so one of the things that we're proposing is shifting the aquatic resources project that division houses over to general fund funding sources. It's a project that benefits many Alaskans far beyond just the recreational angling sector. These are the folks that do things like water reservations to protect fish when there's a proposal for a water withdrawal from a stream. On the flip side of that, Division of Wildlife Conservation also relies heavily on federal funds, but in their case, it's federal funds from excise taxes on sales of guns and ammunition. And because there's been an increase in sales of guns and ammunition over recent years, they have significantly more federal funding available than they have in the past, and really would like to access those funds and use it to shore up some of our scientific programs, some additional biometric support, some additional education programs. And so that's a request that you'll see here. And I just note that it's listed on your slide as $2.5 million, but what that's made up of is $500,000 in general funds that would leverage $2 million in federal dollars. Those federal funds do have a state match requirement. And so that's what we're requesting here, is some funds to match those federal funds. Similarly, in Division of Habitat, they had some federal funds that that went away as a result of no longer being available under Forest Resources Practices Act or the Coastal Zone Management Program. And these were included in our budget as a one-time item last year, and so you'll see it here again because that work continues and the need for the work continues. Going back just for a moment to some of these other salmon projects, these really go back to what I was saying before, where the department is looking for the ability to either shore up some existing assessment programs or maybe restart some projects that we have stopped because of pressure on the budget, but where we think additional knowledge on our part would lead to increased opportunity and a better understanding of what's happening with those stocks. So there's a little bit of that in each region under the Division of Commercial Fisheries. And the next slide talks about capital projects, and we've touched on several of these, but specifically, we've talked about the Chinook Salmon Initiative and the funding to support the research plan and also the licensing modernization. I'd also point out that we have a request for some additional aerial photosensus equipment. And aerial photosensus is one of the Division of Wildlife's main tools when it comes to stock assessment for caribou. And they're relying on a decades-old camera that we can no longer get film for. And so there's a need to have a digital system, and it'll really improve their ability to analyze the photographs once they have them. And also pointing out that we have a request for funding to do another economic impact and contribution of sport fishing study. The study was last done in 2007, and at that time it was designed and the commitment was that the study would be repeated every 5 years so that we would have the ability to track trends over time in the contributions of sport fishing to Alaska's economy. So we're requesting funding in this year's budget to do that survey again for the 2012 fishing year, which would be 5 years after 2007, which was the last time this survey was completed. We've also listed some other capital projects that are more of a recurring nature. Every year we have a request in for sport fish recreational boating access. We have some deferred maintenance in this budget request that is part of the governor's five-year deferred maintenance plan. And then just some additional funds for repair and upgrades on our facilities and vessels and aircraft that's an annual request. So, Mr. Chair, that's what we had for you in terms of a presentation, and wanted to leave some time for questions.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. I've got one request, and then we'll get into questions. I'd like to see something in fairly black and white so that I can just read it real simply on what your core services are. Going back, we're using 2005 as a baseline on a lot of our look back on these things, of what the federal dollars are for those core services, and then a history of how general funds have already started moving into the taking care of those core services. But it would give me some kind of an idea for the future as to what we can expect from looking at general funds for this department.
Okay.
That'll work. All right. And you can get it any time on that. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. I have two questions. The first is that of the departments that we've heard from and their historic rate of growth, your department is about double what we've heard from others. For example, on slide 21, the funding from 2005 to 2023, if we keep the traditional rate of growth, it will quadruple. And so we know from what, you know, from the throughput issue that we're dealing with and our budget constraint that we have to keep the rate of government growth at about 1%. And you mentioned that we haven't even addressed some of the salary increases that will be negotiated. I mean, what is your plan for arresting the growth of government in the department that you oversee as we move forward?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I think there are a couple things that are relevant to this projection that you're seeing and the rate of growth you see in the department. One is that if you go back prior to 2005, you would see a very different picture, and I think that's true for a number of departments, that those were years where the budget was flatter and there wasn't as much growth. One of the things that happened within the department when oil was at a very low price and there was a lot of pressure on budgets is that some of the department's core responsibilities got shifted over to federal funds because federal funds were available for those functions. So I believe that is part of what is driving the trend that you're seeing, is that the department, I think, had an over-reliance on federal funding for core state responsibilities. And as those funds have declined, there has been, as I said, we make an effort internally to weed out projects that we believe should end if the federal funds end, but there have been some core services that we've needed to backfill. Additionally, I think one of the things that you've seen that's a change is general fund going into Division of Wildlife. That is partly necessary because I think the legislature, the administration, Alaskans have an interest in the department doing intensive management for wildlife. That is not something that those aren't programs that we complete with our federal dollars. We're not able to do that. And so I think that's part of what's driving the increase in general fund into the Division of Wildlife is a desire for the department to be able to actually go out and actively manage these populations for increased opportunity. So I guess in answer to your question, I think some of this is growth that you wouldn't necessarily see in the future because we were funding things that hadn't been funded in the past and needed to be funded. But we obviously have a lot of programs where we're attempting to increase hunter recruitment, angler recruitment to try to drive up license sales to increase our ability to be self-supporting with those funds. We're applying a very careful test internally before we ask for backfill in federal funds, and those are some of the strategies that we're using. But maybe I'd see if Kevin has anything to add to that.
Thank you, Commissioner, and through the chair, Representative Costello. Commissioner touched on this, but I think it is significant to note that FY05 was chosen as the last year of flat budgets, and so this has been a decade of growth, and different financial environment will dictate different decisions, whether it's coming from the department or the legislature as far as funding. So I think if you did go back another 10 years and did a trend line with 10 years of flat budgets and 10 years of growth that kind of made up for that, it would change the dynamic and it might change the discussion. But ultimately it comes down to us closely reviewing these projects and being responsible in what we propose to you for funding.
Additional question, Mr. Chair?
Commissioner,
as you know, I'm a former educator, and I understand that's in your peripheral background as well. And so I was wondering if you could give the committee a grade for your department, both in terms of management of fish in river and commercial, and then for the management of game, and then perhaps an overall grade.
Through the chair, Representative Costello, thank you for that. I think perhaps people with an educational background like you and I have could debate the merits of a letter grading system for understanding the subtleties of performance. But I guess what I would say is I think on the wildlife side, we're doing very well. We've been able to increase herd sizes that Alaskans rely on. We're providing a lot of additional opportunity. We're spending significant resources on developing partnerships to increase hunter recruitment and retention, and so I think that is overall, I would say that's a success story. I think if you look at the fisheries side, it's probably more difficult to talk about fisheries management as being a success after this past season that we went through. But I think the understanding needs to be that, the department doesn't necessarily control every aspect of salmon abundance, for example. And so many times we're reacting to what's put before us in terms of a management challenge. So I don't know that that Alaskans would be as happy if they were asked to grade to the department on fisheries management based on some of the restrictions that had to take place this past season. But I think that given the circumstances that they're reacting to, our biologists are doing the best they can to protect the resource and balance that with the need to provide opportunity.
Follow up?
Yes.
I find it interesting that, and I appreciate your response. You obviously, I'm thinking, okay, A and then C, D, so average of B minus perhaps. I don't know. But what I find interesting is the mission of the department in terms of requesting a capital appropriation for the Chinook salmon research. And I struggle sometimes with requests from departments that fall really into their mission but show up as a capital request, and so that's really just more of a comment, and perhaps we could talk about that later at some other time.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might just respond quickly, there are a blend of projects in the Chinook Research Plan. Some of them really are short-term projects where we could do the project, we could increase our understanding, and the project would end. In other cases, we may find, as we get to the end of the five-year plan, that there are projects in there that we think have value for continuing in the long term. And if that's the case, again, this is a ways down the road, but you may see a request for ongoing funding for those projects as part of the department's operational budget. But at this point, because there's a blend and because it's only a portion of those that may have value as long-term projects, it's a capital request at this time.
Thank you.
Representative Stultz.
Well, thank you. Maybe we can get out of the, if we go down the scholastic chain just a little bit, let's go to grade school. We used to get O's, S's, and N's, and I had an abundance of, I got some charity S minuses on penmanship, maybe that's that might be, because if you're going to ask for some big increments, how do we know if you can't assess yourself even as a passing or failing or needs improvement or satisfactory or outstanding? Let's go down to the grade school level, O, S, or N.
Through the chair, Representative Stultz, as I mentioned,
did you give yourself an outstanding on
as I mentioned
fisheries?
To Representative Costello, I think the department's doing an outstanding job with wildlife management. I think if we were talking about fisheries management, I would say that the department did a satisfactory job of reacting to what was in front of us this past season. Is that helpful?
Well, it's a more direct answer, so it's appreciated, and no needs improvements. I got a few of those.
Through the chair, Representative Stultz, I certainly think that there are areas within what the department works on where we have identified a need for improvement, and that's part of what has what drove us as we put together our budget request for FY14 is identifying those needs for improvement and trying to put together an initiative to address them.
This wasn't a self-confession about my early academic career. The other just one last question on the economic impact study of sport fish. If we do it again, what do we expect to do with the information, and how do we expect it to influence better economic related decisions by the department and the boards of fish? Are we just going to do the study and say, well, boy, what a dynamic industry we had or used to have or could have? But if we're not going to, how will your department react to that in a proactive manner once you get that updated information?
Co-Chair Stultz, we use that information in a number of different forums. You'll see it come out at times in the Board of Fish process when that economics is one of the criteria that they consider when they're making their decisions, and so I think it's useful in that process. We use it for planning purposes when we're working on stocking and enhancement programs so that we can see where the angler interest is and where angler activity would really contribute a lot to the economy if we were able to boost opportunity. So that is the type of thing that we use that information for.
Do you just one last closing. Do you think economic impact and economic benefit should have a greater role in allocation decisions?
Co-Chair Stultz, I think it's it's one of the criteria that the boards consider, and I think that in different circumstances they put different weight on that criteria, but the allocative parts of it are really something that the board is tasked with.
I've done my best, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I actually found what I was looking for a little bit under. My question was dealing with coastal zone management in the previous program that was there, and I asked DEC this, asked DNR this, but you know, I kind of expected to see somewhere at some point in time agencies that are taking on the responsibilities in previous roles, and I can see that there's a small increment of GF there. Is that the entire amount? Because Habitat Division did have a role to play in that.
So through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, what you see in the increment request is that we used to receive an RSA from DNR for some of the work that came along with permitting projects in the coastal zone. And the fact of the matter for Fish and Game is that we have the same permitting responsibilities for projects in the coastal zone that we had before. The process is slightly different, but the work is still there for our department. We still have those permitting responsibilities. And so that's why you see a request to replace that funding, is because the work still needs to be done by Habitat staff.
I have a second question. On the sport fish hatchery for Fairbanks, and we have Fairbanks representatives here, and we're happy and excited that it's producing fish now. The one comment, and maybe you could address it somewhere, if it's addressed somewhere in the budget, the original plan was to use heated water, wastewater, that was coming off the power plant, which is co-located fairly close to downtown. Didn't work out. They're on oil. The price of electricity in 2005 or 2004, when the plan was through, is probably a quarter or third of what it is today. I guess I'm curious why there isn't, I guess the expense is there, but it's not reflected. Is it reflected somewhere in the budget that we can see?
The
operational costs.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we actually have a separate component in the sport fish budget so that the cost of operating the hatcheries can be easily identified and looked at from year to year. But if you're asking whether there's an increment in FY14 to account for increased operating costs, there isn't. But because we have that separate component, we can easily pull that out if you're interested.
I will be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
We'll just start out on the page that we're on here. When I look at the budget growth within a department, at a 9.6% annual growth rate, and I'll obviously give into the fact that growth rate in a department at least 3 or 4% is uncontrollable. You know, just contractual obligations, inflation, and all that. So, using that as a measurement tool, because we're trying to go back to I've been trying to look at all of our budgets based more of a zero-based budgeting and drawing a line in comparison to the input and output that we have that we're, you know, asked to do with missions and measures on these. So I go back to your core mission statement. Again, to protect, maintain, improve fish and game resources to the state, manage their uses in a development in the best interest of the economy and well-being of the people, consistent with sustained yield. So if we were to look at fish and game, and I will also give you the fact that fish is hard to manage. We really don't know what goes on in the ocean. We don't have control of that. But if you can try and talk to the fish end a little bit, and but more in particular on the game end also, if we increase the amount of game that's available, but the total allowable harvest of game to Alaskans, you know, so again, as a sustained yield principle, using this as a manageable, renewable resource to feed Alaskans. Do we have more game that's available for Alaskans, 3 or 4 or 5% more at all? Or where would you see we were at on that, like from 05 to now? Are we doing that? Are we allowing more allowable harvest? Is there more game available for Alaskans to use?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I don't know that I've looked at it on an aggregate basis since 2005, but what I would say is that I believe that there's more hunting opportunity available for Alaskans now as a result of the department's activities. Just to give you a couple of examples, the South Alaska Peninsula caribou herd, that was completely shut down. There was no subsistence hunting opportunity. The department went in there and removed some predators, and we saw a 50% increase in the size of that herd. And it's now open again. It's providing hunting opportunity. We have a couple, three GMUs up in 20 where we have programs going on, and we've seen elevated harvest levels, and it accounts for, you know, 27% of the total statewide moose harvest comes out of those subunits where we have these programs going. So I absolutely believe that those programs are resulting in increased hunting opportunity for Alaskans.
Just follow up a couple questions. So it's your sense that there is more game being harvested by Alaskans now?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I don't want to give you a misleading answer. So I would have to look at total harvests for this year compared to 2005, if that's what you're interested in. But I absolutely, unequivocally think that there is more game harvest now by Alaskans as a result of the department's activities than there would be if we did not have intensive management going on.
I believe with the intensive management end of it. And that's, I think, probably a large part of why we have more. Again, I'm just trying to measure this out, you know, because with moose now, we're basically at a spike 53 or 4 brow tang statewide on a whole. And so I know that harvestable moose, you know, has gone down considerably for a lot of Alaskans on that. And I'm just trying to see, you know, what the management decisions that are made by the department there. Working with your biologists, they make those decisions on what we're going to be doing on that. And if there, what are there ways or areas that you think that we could improve in?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I think that there are a couple of things. One is that I mentioned before that some of our management programs, we review and refine those every year when they go through the Board of Game process. I think one good example of that is the program that we have going on in 16B, where we have wolf control and some provisions for bear harvest. But even with that program, even though we've seen the population get close to the population objectives, we're still not meeting harvest objectives for moose. So one of the things that we're going to do, you know, at the Board of Game meeting coming up is talk about ways to refine and improve that program. The other thing that I would say that we could do, and we're in the process of implementing, is additional work on habitat improvement. So we have some efforts going on the Kenai and in the Matsu Valley to try to work on some habitat improvement projects to increase moose availability. So those are the two areas where I really see a potential for some increased work and some increased harvest as a result.
One more question, Mr. Chair. When we look at, again, your mission statement with the interest of the economy, and this is the department's mission statement, that, you know, we should manage these in the development best interest of the economy. And Representative Stoltz asked you about, you know, the economics and what you felt as a commissioner. Should economics be a larger part in the management decisions that are made either by the board or advice to the department to the board? The board does allocation. The department sets allowable harvest. You know, so looking at the interest of our economy, making sure that, you know, in the Matsu region, that had an impact that's estimated over $100 million because of the lack of salmon, and it was devastating to our community to the point where there was an economic disaster, not just there, but on the Kenai and the AYK areas of the state. So as the commissioner, do you feel that we should address the issue of economics when we're measuring how those allocations are appropriated?
So through the chair, Representative Newman, we do consider economics in our decision making. And one of the things that I spoke about a bit earlier is that we're looking at places where we can increase economic opportunity through better department decision making. So if we had better information available to us, we could make better decisions and we could increase economic opportunity that's available to Alaskans. And that's one of the primary things that we look at when we're putting our budget together, is where are those places where we could do a better job of providing economic opportunity. So that's something that we're absolutely looking at. And while we do work within the allocation and management plans that the Board of Fish adopts, we still have the responsibility and the opportunity to consider the economics of the fisheries that we're managing when we're making our decisions.
You do have that opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. My question has to do with king salmon. If you could go to page 26. I think whether you're a commercial fisherman, sport fisherman, or a subsistence user, we're all really concerned about the dwindling stocks of king salmon statewide. So I just want to see what this initiative will do. You know, the numbers are down on the Yukon. They're down on rivers south of the Yukon. They're down in south central in the most major streams. They're down in Kodiak. I profess less knowledge about southeast. But with the $10 million for this King Chinook Salmon Initiative, is that going to give us answers on why we're in such danger of losing this wild fishery in all these areas, or just in certain areas?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the initiative and the research plan focus on 12 stocks that are throughout the state. So from southeast all the way up the coast to the Yukon, we have stocks included. And a big part of the research that would be funded, if this were approved, would be some work that the department hasn't done much of in recent years, but it would be smolt out migration work, so that we would have a sense of what we're putting into the marine environment. And that work is really critical to understanding whether your productivity problem is related to something that's happening in freshwater, whether it's freshwater conditions or habitat or predators or what have you, or whether it's something related to survival in the marine environment. So I guess I don't mean to go on and on. The answer to your question is yes. The plan is designed to give us answers about why we're in this predicament statewide from southeast all the way up to the Yukon.
Thank you, the chair. I just want to make sure if we're going to fund this that we're not skipping streams. The Matsu is devastated as well. The Susitna drainage salmon, is that part of, and the Kenai Peninsula streams in addition to the Yukon River ones, but Matsu and the Kenai Peninsula streams, are those covered?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes. The plan includes work on the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, in the Chinook area, the Kodiak area, the Susitna drainage, the Kenai Peninsula, the Copper River, and southeast Alaska.
Okay. Thanks. Then if your answers point to high seas interception of king salmon, what is the department's ability to do anything about that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it depends on whether the mortality that we find is in domestic federal water fisheries between 300 and 200 miles, or mortality beyond 200 miles, or as a result of illegal fishing. But either way, we have a mechanism to address it if we discover that's a major contributor. As commissioner, I sit on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which manages the fisheries from 300 to 200 miles, and through that position, I have the ability to at least influence what happens in federal fisheries. Beyond that, we're involved in a number of international bodies that negotiate on things like high seas drift net enforcement with other Pacific Rim countries and international bodies that discuss management of things like you know, the pollock stock crosses the Alaska-Russian border, and so there's an international commission that discusses management of those fisheries. And so we have some ability to influence both enforcement on the high seas and scientific exchange and that type of thing to understand what's happening outside the 200-mile border.
Thank you. Just finally, Mr. Chair, it's going to take a while for you to get the answers from this initiative, but what we do know is that a significant number of king salmon are being intercepted and just dumped dead back into the water on the high seas level. Would you be able to, I can talk to you about it later, but would you be able to get us the numbers of king salmon that are being intercepted and then just, I think they're thrown overboard, right? By the various gear types and where, to the extent you have that information?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra, we have that information with a fair degree of certainty for the domestic fisheries, so 300 to 200 miles, and we can easily provide that. And I guess one of the things that I've been working on at the council is getting caps and controls on bycatch in some of those fisheries that didn't have any at all. For example, the Gulf of Alaska fisheries had no limits on Chinook salmon bycatch. So that's been a major initiative that we've been working on through the council process. So we can provide some information on that as well, where we've been able to put a limit in place, other fisheries where we're still working to get a limit.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Concise presentation, all 35 minutes for a major agency. I think that's almost an accomplishment in itself, so appreciate the brevity. I think the job well done. Want to as well thank you, Commissioner, for your role in getting the Board of Fish out to Bristol Bay. It's important to have the both the Board of Fish and the Board of Game be present in the outlying regions that are being affected. That's something that I'm going to continue to push for. Some of the questions I was going to ask a different question, but a couple of my questions were already asked. But so I'm going to ask about the ocean acidification. Maybe give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about that. I don't know if you have your council hat back on or not, but just talk about where that is. You know, heard you talk about invasive species earlier and how fortunate we are here in Alaska. But maybe give you a moment to talk about ocean acidification, if you could.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, ocean acidification is something that's of great concern, I think, to the fishing industry in Alaska, and there's specifically concern about impacts on organisms that need to form shells for survival, and what a change in the ocean's pH could do to those organisms, as well as some of the organisms that are primary prey species for salmon, and so. The University of Alaska has really taken the lead in trying to develop some research around monitoring acidity levels in the oceans off Alaska to at least provide us with some baseline information about where we are right now and then early detection of trends that we might see that could be harmful to our marine organisms. So that's something that the university has been working on, and we have a cooperative relationship with, for example, the Alaska Ocean Observing System that provides sea conditions and some of that information.
Okay, one more question, then we got to move on to the next department. Representative Wilson.
I only have one question, Mr. Chair. So you were saying that we have more hunting opportunities and that the wildlife numbers are good. So, and you don't have to give me an answer here, but on the guide concession program, if our numbers are doing well and it doesn't seem like we have less hunting opportunities, I'd like to know, you know, why you might believe as a department head, why we need the program, and if you do, why it shouldn't be Fish and Game that's doing it, since it'd be about the number of animals, not necessarily about the land. And I know it's kind of complicated, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but I would like to hear, you know, get a statement through the chair why you would think that we would or would not need it, and why Fish and Game wouldn't be the one running it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the development that's gone on so far of a guide concession program has been
primarily through DNR because it has to do with access and use of state lands, but it's been a cooperative effort between the two agencies because, as you mentioned, a critical part of it has to do with wildlife harvest. And so we've been integrally involved in the development of that program as it relates to harvest opportunities and impacts on wildlife. And so what I would say is that while we've been able to, in many cases, increase herd sizes and increase hunting opportunity, we certainly haven't eliminated every conflict that exists between resident and non-resident hunters. There certainly are places where there isn't enough harvest opportunity to sort of go around for everybody that's interested. And so what the Board of Game has said on multiple occasions is that if there isn't a program developed to allow some kind of regulation of the guide industry and of guided hunting opportunity, that the alternative, in their point of view, to resolve some of these allocated disputes that they've had to deal with is that they will need to find other ways to limit non-resident hunting opportunity. And the reaction to that from the guide industry has been that those other options could be extremely destabilizing. If you're relying on, for example, a draw permit and the luck of the draw to find out whether or not a potential client of yours is even going to have the ability to book a hunt, I think the industry sees that as being difficult to deal with and being destabilizing. So we've tried to support that process where we can and really explain what we see the impacts being on wildlife.
Hey, we're running over on our time. Representative Stoltz, you had a comment in reference to the subcommittee.
Yeah, the subcommittee, which we'll have the meeting scheduled for next week. There's a lot of interesting questions around this table, and sometimes it seems like we're using single unbaited hooks with limited openings trying to get answers. Take advantage of working through me in my office, and the co-chair is also on that. Things you want addressed, please bring them towards us from all regions of the state. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner Kevin.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We will take a very short brief at ease while we bring in the next department. Call the meeting back to order. We have now an overview from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. General, welcome. If you want to introduce yourself and your presenters and who might be here supporting you, and it's your table.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Tom Katkus, I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and also the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard. With me today is my Deputy McHugh Pierre.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We've got a video to start out our presentation. We were telling war stories in the past, and we noticed they could get long in the tooth. So last year we showed a video, and it was well received, so we decided we'd continue with the tradition. So.
well, just as he's hitting play, this is put together by some of our real younger members in the military and our state folks. So we're looking at a product of some youngsters that are about 21, 22 years of age. So
this sensor?
It is. It speaks well of the quality service members that we have.
Request for support from Cordova, there are several things we have to consider. One is we have to get there fast, we have to get there with aid, and it's not a drain on the community, and we needed to have the discipline to work in bad conditions. And we decided fairly immediately that the National Guard was the way to do this mission.
Desperate
immunity,
extra bodies, extra manpower, extra equipment, we are all extremely grateful for the National Guard right now.
I was in a building, but the wind was so strong, it was rocked a bit. I wasn't parking it here 120 miles. And it would be different if it was just the wind or the rain. But when you have both, you have massive flooding going on and everything else. This is just, I've been here since 92, and I've never seen it.
A
City Emergency Operations Center is the focal point for all of that information coming in. Request from local government, providing information to other agencies that need to know what's going on in the disaster. And the State Emergency Operations Center is the place where all of that coordination and support happens. That absolutely makes the state's job easier. Like I said previously, it's important that individuals and families have a disaster supply kit at their home that has adequate food, water for their family to support them for 7 days, medicine, vital records, all of the things that you would need following a catastrophic event.
Here, equipment and doctors, nurses, veterinarians, such as other drugs, other things. 10 minutes and a half, an hour now, it'll be rocket setting right now, the fight is all over. Then in 15, 20 minutes to get closed up, do it first.
Okay, very rewarding. We're finding these patients aren't having glasses and we're turning around in less than a day.
It's not only about providing the actual health care with education too. We can come in and educate them on how to take care of their eyes to wear sunglasses, because the teaching and the instructing that we've done to help them take care of themselves is amazing.
We read the preamble to the U.S. Constitution that says that establishing justice and keeping the peace are the first two goals of government. And what this company is doing in several different places in Afghanistan is helping the provinces establish a legitimate government. And that's just tremendous. I think these soldiers will remember this for the rest of their lives as something incredibly important.
That's all I can think about. I dream about it. And to get home and actually be able to hug my loved ones and see them again for the first time in so long is a huge thing.
A Hurricane Sandy crashing on shore, winds now at 90 miles per hour, and this storm is so big, so vast, 60 million Americans will feel its power.
We are in the midst of a massive operation to move utility vehicles, power vehicles, from the Southern California area to the New York, New Jersey area, which is currently millions of customers are without power.
No, it's great. Working with a small team, because I used to deploy with the Marine Corps, so this is different. We flew everything in the south last time we were up north.
So we were able to fly a lot more missions there.
Yeah, what they're deploying means for the state of Alaska here is that they are on the front lines. They're serving us. They've got families behind as well that we want to support in any way we can. So we appreciate them. We appreciate their service. And we're here to help support their families.
Brave and courageous warriors exited an aircraft while in flight by a cable hoisting system under extreme and intense circumstances to recover fellow combatants wounded during ground combat operations with the enemy.
There's just so much more than just a medal, and it's you know, it's not about me, it's not about the medal, it's about the sacrifices that, you know, we as soldiers make on a daily basis, and that soldiers are still giving.
We found another Alaska Territorial Guard member that is actually living. Most people within our communities don't even know what these elderly guys did for us. We were able to find this individual and actually reward him for his service and present him with his honorable discharge.
Our guide shows the final respects for the fallen soldier, as well as shows most families the last thing they'll ever see with the military. It's to show the family how much we care for them. It's to show our respect to that fallen soldier. You have my great respect for this. You are without doubt one of the best classes in the history of this program.
We all came to this program for different reasons, where some needed discipline, others needed school credits. Some had little say in the matter, or came for lack of a better option. Regardless of our reasons for entering AMYA, we have all received something valuable from our time.
Membership level, or S&P for our Guardsmen College, is a program for guardsmen and reservists to be in RTC and be a drilling guardsman or reservist at the same time.
I joined the Alaska National Guard for the benefits for college because I looked at college and I wanted to go all these different places and study all these different things, and I realized, wow, I have no way of paying for this.
The program really helps cadets succeed by mentorship. I think one of the best opportunities that we have is the cadres, at least 3 times a semester, to be with cadets to make sure they're on track academically, financially, physically fit, and just all around in good character for the program.
Significant. Lockheed Martin, of course, has selected Kodiak for their Athena program. The state, through this legislative session, provided us $25 million in seed money to start the work on developing the Launchpad 3. And that really has secured Lockheed Martin's commitment to Kodiak. Because now it shows that there's viability, and not just for Launchpad 3 with Lockheed Martin, but with other customers that are very interested in using those products.
When we were over there away from our families and our friends, and it meant a lot to us that people back here in Alaska, our home state, were thinking about us and writing us letters.
We can invite various TV and industry leaders to come to us, not only celebrate Alaska, but also the invaluable institutions that give so much to the community, in particular our wounded warriors, who did so much for their country, and we hope we can give a little back to them.
He has a Duchenne muscular dystrophy. He's 9 years old. The life expectancy right now is...
We dropped everything for this.
You're down just a little bit.
The entire day, we've been prepping for him for the past couple of weeks. So, best experience we can give him in a little long time.
It melts your heart no matter what, you're a kid. And, to see them open their prayers and just having a good time, it just melts your heart. So, even the hardest pilot, he melts once he sees those kids opening the prayers.
This is speaking out. This is saying we are going to change our community. We're going to put people in place that will represent us well in the legislature. It will lead us, as the governor is doing now, in 123 communities in a short order of 3 years and have that much support and that much demonstrated physical presence and community outspokenness, saying they're no longer going to accept it.
I believe that through you, today's participants, as well as your predecessors and those who come in your footsteps, Hunt contributed its own share to the betterment of the defense forces of all of your countries as well.
And I think we finally, after 20 years, realized this is an option to bring our state workforce in, other areas that make efficiency and synchronization of resources in today's resource-constrained environment absolutely essential. NORTHCOM now sees that as, man, that's a model example of how state and federal partners should be getting together and making good things happen at time of disasters and time of need.
Chairman, thank you for allowing us to show that video. I think the biggest challenge is trying to compress all of it into less than 11 minutes. The magnitude is pretty impressive sometimes. What that leads into is to cover the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs mission, and the mission to provide military forces. Obviously, that's a preponderance of what we see. That's probably the most visible, but across the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, we've got other areas that certainly comply with this mission as demonstrated in the video. To provide military forces to accomplish military missions in the state and around the world, provide homeland security and defense, emergency response, veteran service, and youth military-style training and education. Primary mission is where we move forward, and I think that video does a great job of demonstrating that. Our core services, we tried to narrow those down to four easy core services and try to block everything into that. Defend and protect Alaska and the United States, disaster preparedness, response and recovery, youth intervention, outreach to veterans and military affairs. Two charts that are before you trying to hit upon some of our real metrics. Obviously, with the uniformed members, our requirements for training and deployments, we've met all of the metrics that we've been required of the federal government and or state in response to emergencies. Some of the lesser known metrics that are out there that are critical, that I see as very, very critical to our state, is in the youth academy area. We're showing on that graph almost 300 on average at-risk youth students that graduate from the youth academy. And when you take the cost of those students but compare it to all of those kids, all of them were on a crash course towards our correctional facilities. And the amount of to incarcerate those young men and women and or compensate victims of crime, etc., pale in comparison to the fairly negligible costs as getting them through this program. So I think we're having tremendous results, and we continue to do very well in that particular arena. The next area, which is a very positive, measurable amount, is the one-time benefit payments for our veterans. Our veterans in the state of Alaska are very hard to track because a lot of them feel, I don't need the service, somebody else needs it more. We continue our efforts to try to get every veteran registered. That's a metric that drives additional federal resources to support them. But even with that said, the efforts that we're making through our outreach programs to get out and interact through our veteran service officers and our volunteers in our communities that start to see the progress and the relevancy of getting registered and applying, you look at the increase from 2005 to 2012. Again, those aren't additive. Those are continual one-time benefits that each year that much additional funding is brought in through the efforts of just pay and benefits, reimbursements of earned benefits that our veterans have rightfully earned. Now, if I can, this is a general fund budget. And some of my staff had looked at that for a while. On the left is what the normal budget looks like. And you can see that the DMVA budget, we work a lot on federal sites, and we've got some state monies. And our state money on our budget graph is really 0.44%, less than half a percent of the overall state budget. But you look at that graph, and it still looks pretty big because relatively everything moves. If you look to the right, though, that's where the staff put together. You can't see it there, but if you have the printout in front of you, that little purple line that is about a number 05 pencil lead, maybe on a good day, maybe some of the thinner dental floss that you have to pick your teeth, that little line represents 0.044% of the state budget. So that video and all that that demonstrated is kind of the tip of the iceberg of what we do. That's your investment from the state to make that happen. So I thought the comparison of those two graphs was an appropriate place to bring forward here. One other area of concern as far as graphs go, if you look on the left again, a budget comparison, you look at those last 2 years, and the general fund budget near the end is the only area that appears to have grown. And that's with our absorption or the now having aerospace aligned under Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and that brings a little bit of a growth on that particular graph. So again, the staff said, hey, let's look at this other in a different format. So what we did, the top graph on the right is a breakout of just the aerospace budget. So if you look down then to our budget, as it would be there with no aerospace, you can see that our general fund is very consistent. We have not expanded our programs. We've stayed with what we said we're going to do. And it's very good is not only we've stayed within my current term, but I've been following on the heels of General Campbell, who's seated in the room here today, and he did a very good job of stabilizing and continuing this effort. So I have direct supervision and oversight, rightfully so, on a regular basis. No pressure here at all. Anyway, I think the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for general funds does a very, very good job of applying that money. Looking at our 10-year plan, and this is what we're looking out there as far as projected potential moves. Mostly in the area, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record as well, total funds. So we just wanted to make sure that you knew that this was all federal authority as well for future projects happening.
So when you look at those large increases and you have the federal funds in for potential buildings that could be out there, the USPFO building, which is kind of a large facility that captures all control of the federal equipment that rolls into the state of Alaska. That facility, the aerospace project, and then a potential Fairbanks Armory, those would be your larger increases of total federal funding. And again, our lower line, though, continues to remain constant. Then the 10-year plan, general funds, again, should those buildings and construction and the cost, the shared cost of the state grants, not state grants, but the match money, that would be our projected increase. Again, fairly consistent, very predictable, and stable in the way we move forward. A lot of talk about sequestration and what the budget is going to be impacted in this definitely a resource-constrained environment. So federal funding and sequestration is probably our highest priority in trying to evaluate how that could impact the state and how we're going to continue with our programs. And I see that as something which is very, very manageable for the state of Alaska. We're very fortunate to have aligned most of our missions and efforts along active duty federal missions that aren't going to see a drastic impact. But still, BRAC and the base alignment and closure process is something that still could hit some of our communities, and every state certainly has that as a priority. So dropping down to those areas, then we get more local, and again, our military youth formula, trying to get that in line, and then the aerospace contracts, and finally developing the cemetery in the interior of Alaska. So those are our priority issues. This is fairly quick overview. I'm certainly open to any questions, but I think in combination with the video, this was an effective way to put out there. I hope I've answered any questions you may have, but I'm certainly open to questions. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll start out with, let's go back to page 8. Between 8 and 9, knowing just a little bit what I know about aerospace, on page 8, the shaded line, the gray line, current level of service plus initiative, I assume that partially incorporates continuing development of aerospace.
Projected anticipated development of aerospace, correct.
So if you go to page 9, though you drop I don't see the growth pattern if we continue. I know that for the next few years we're going to be looking at a general fund request and I assume expenditures out there. So I don't know if that.
Representative Osterman, Craig Campbell for the record. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Aerospace. We're aligned under DMVA, and so I may not understand the question accurately. I'll tell you that for our funding and how, let's go to the shaded one. Yeah, that one there. What that slide is showing you on the right-hand side, which I concur with, is that the top chart on the right-hand side shows the $8 million that we've requested. Last year we received $8 million, and the governor's requesting in this year's budget, which shows in the subsequent slides the peak that DMVA is having to cover, which is created by us being added to the department and having that new need. So that's an $8 million request from last year, an $8 million request for this year that's added to the DMVA budget. So I think what DMVA is trying to say is that's kind of skews their chart. If you're just looking at the total department, it's flat, except for this change that's been created by putting Alaska Aerospace inside DMVA.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, McHugh Pierre, just to add on to that, if you look at page 8 and then you go to page 9, we're doing our best to reflect the match requirements of GF to the projects. So what we tried to show was with the total amount of federal money and outside partner money that's going to be involved, so far this is what we anticipate spending. Now, as we pursue, Aerospace pursues the third launch pad for the medium lift rocket capability, that may change, and we'll continue to update our graphs as we present to you guys.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just add to that what you're seeing with the bottom line, which is flat, is the baseline. And then you go up $25 million, basically. As you go across the top there, $25 million is what was put in the budget last year for us. We've only spent one. We're still waiting for the rest of the contract agreements with Lockheed. But that's a flat $25 million that is accounted for Alaska Aerospace development, with the two additional peaks above that being what you would see for Fairbanks and for, I can't read it, the USPFO.
The $25 million is basically a one-time expenditure, so I don't know why it would continue across. And so,
just to add on there, Mr. Chairman, McHugh again for the record, it's reflected in the fiscal year we anticipate spending it. That's why it would go up and then come back down and go up. So
you're going to spend it all the way out through 2023.
Yeah, we anticipate spending it along the way. Correct. So it's maybe it's not the best slide, but it was our best attempt to show that slide and show that funding.
Mr. Chairman, again, Commissioner Katkus, I think, so there's no confusion, the 10-year plan showing all funds is those authorities, too, so the money coming in federal and state, but then the next one is our general fund obligation of what we anticipate having to take state monies and either match federal funding or continue out that we're going to make that investment. So big difference between the two charts, but one is all-inclusive and one just hits upon the
understood. You don't highlight the $8 million as part of that gray line right there, the top line. Right. Within what you're talking about, office, barracks, armory. If that line, gray line that you see there, is actually part of the continuing general fund expenditures, then is that correct? Or is that the assumption?
You're correct, Mr. Chairman. In fact, this is the 10-year plan, and perhaps CEO Campbell can talk about his 10-year plan for just a second, but we anticipate some spending changes as well into the future. So the $8 million isn't a long-term spending plan. So that's why you see that graph go down a little bit on page 9 here. So when we look at straight general funds, it does decrease a little bit. Now, if we add in other things that we project, we do see some big projects on the horizon potentially. That's why the light gray line goes up.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Representative Kawasaki and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for coming in earlier. I appreciate that. I guess, can you tell me where this graph came from, like where the numbers are from? I'm looking at the 10-year from the OMB.
Is that where those numbers came from to produce that graph?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's correct.
Okay.
So that includes all GF, and then this is all funds. And it's from our 10-year plan.
Okay. Okay. The follow-up question then for Craig. Now I'm looking at the aerospace, Alaska Aerospace Corporation. We had a meeting earlier today about it, and I guess I was we didn't get to write down the numbers that you mentioned, but you know, anticipating future contracts, potentially federal funds being able to supplant some funds into the future. But I'm looking at the OMB 10-year forward, and it doesn't seem to reflect that. And I'm just curious if you can explain why it wouldn't.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, Craig Campbell, I'm not sure what paper you have in front of you, but what we sent into OMB is that our 10-year plan would reflect $8 million in GF for this year, that's before you now in the governor's budget, $6 million next year, $4 million the year after, and $2 million the following year for GF support. And that would be a decline, $2 million a year for the next 4 years, based on increased contracts and other revenues coming in. At the five-year point, I flatten out at $2 million because the 5 to 10-year period is a little fuzzier. I am working trying to get some federal matching funds that would apply, and we do anticipate some more launches. But for now, I'm very comfortable with the five-year, the initial 5 years being 8 years this year, 6, 4, and 2. And that should be what OMB has.
Mr. Chairman, I might be looking at it wrong, but this is the ones that we got in the subcommittee the other day, and it doesn't have any. It's zero after 2017. I mean, zero is across the board
through the chair.
Operations and sustainment.
For the record, McHugh again, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that might not be reflective of the most accurate information.
Okay.
I can't tell you, but I know that's what we submitted. Maybe in government it'll be changed, but that's what we plan on operating with. And we'll also go into more detail as well on February 18th in Budget Subcommittee, specifically for aerospace.
I have a second question, Mr. Chair.
On the
Veterans Cemetery up in Fairbanks, there's a request, or there's a $75,000, I can't remember what it is, mentioning for the, it says for the maintenance and operation of the cemetery. Do we have a cemetery yet, or what's that exactly for?
Through the chair, this is McHugh again, Representative Kawasaki. Our intent, we have money in the capital budget this year to buy land. As you know, we've been looking at purchasing, or I should say building, a cemetery up in the interior. And we did our best to get land for free. We went through DNR, the university. We tried to get some local folks to donate land. The land that we did find that was best, we had core samples done, and I want to say 32 out of 34 core samples came up with permafrost as much as 10 inches below the top of the soil. So it just wasn't a usable piece of land. Now we must, according to the VA, have something larger than 40 acres. We'd like to have about 100 acres. And I know many of you in the room have been in discussions with us about this. We've come to a point where we have to buy land. We had an RFI this summer asking to see who would have land available for sale and what do they think they would want to sell it for, so we could kind of gauge how much we would want to spend on land. And we have a $2.5 million budget request in, and we look to your guys' support to cover that difference. We think $3 million is what it's totally going to cost for land. And then once we get that money in the budget, we anticipate doing an RFP this summer, July, so we can buy land. Once we have land in title, the VA is going to give us the money to build, and then we'll be in operations in the last quarter of fiscal year 14. And that's what the $75,000 reflects, is the final quarter of operations. So that's when we'll actually be interning people in the cemetery. And we believe it's going to cost $300,000 a year to maintain and operate the cemetery. So that's one quarter of that money.
Follow up on the $2.5 million that's in the capital budget request for the land. So we're, what's the value of the land, I guess, and who owns the land? And,
well, there's,
I guess,
through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we don't know. We know that people responded to the RFI and said, hey, we we might have some land for sale, and based on what people were saying, some people came in at 800,000, some people came in at 10 or 15 million, and it depended on where you were at and how much land. So that's what we think is the best, working with the community there, working with the Interior delegation and realtor input. So if it comes time, we have an RFP, and depending on how much money we receive from you guys, we certainly hope we can get at least 100 acres and fulfill that promise that our veterans would like to see in the Interior.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair. I know how important the Aerospace Development Corporation is to your community, and it produces jobs, and we want to diversify the economy, so I would certainly talk to you as time goes on. I'm concerned about the Aerospace Development Corporation. So can you tell me, between capital and operating budget money, how much money we put in FY13 into the Aerospace Development Corporation?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, Craig Campbell again, Alaska Aerospace. Last year's budget included $8 million in the general operating budget for operations and sustainment of the Kodiak Launch Complex and Alaska Aerospace Corporation for 1 year. And additionally, the legislature supported the governor's request to put in a $25 million capital budget line for development of a new medium lift launch pad. That is got some criteria. It's set in three different gates. The first gate is that we can spend no more than $3 million until we have a firm launch schedule from a customer, which we expect to be Lockheed Martin, who is we're discussing with right now. Once that schedule has been confirmed and we have launch dates established, we can spend $10 million more to start the full engineering design for that specific facility and go for the financing package, because the total launch complex will be in around $125 million. Once we secure the additional revenue funding, the other $100 million, we can then use the last $12 million to go into full construction of the complex.
Through the Chair. Hello. You've talked about $8 million requested this year. Is $6 million, $4 million, $2 million? Is there capital money you're going to be requesting on top of that?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, in the capital budget this year, we have a request of about $185,000 for a rebuilding of the weather station we have out at Kodiak. It's a weather balloon storage and operations building. And we also, for the first time, have had the administration support our request for deferred maintenance. We have about a $4 to $5 million deferred maintenance backlog at the launch site, and the administration will be requesting just under $1 million in deferred maintenance so we can catch up on some of the equipment repairs.
Mr. Chair. Just for this fiscal year, your best estimate, what is the state general fund and non-general fund cost of running the facility, and what is the income that's been generated?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, we have no launches scheduled for this year. We have no contracts. This year, like last year, are the 2 years that we need the state support while we change our business development plan and we acquire new customers. And so if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'll take just a couple minutes to let everybody know what that means. For 15 years, we've had Alaska Aerospace and the Kodiak Launch Complex. We've done 16 launches. And over those 15, 16 years, the state has provided about $30 to $35 million in support to the complex. And in return, we've received about $145, $150 million in federal money to build the complex, and about another $140, $150 million in revenues from launching 16 rockets. So we've received a little under $300 million against the $30 million or so, rough numbers, that the state has put in. We became very complacent, and we relied for the years around 2006 to 2009 just to work with Missile Defense Agency. They were our primary customer, our only customer, and they paid all the bills. We were negligent in going out and doing much marketing for other customers, and so in 2009, when MDA advised us that they would be moving their program to Kwajalein in the Pacific, we had no other customers that we could build from. So we asked in 2010 for some money to help sustain that year, and we realized that since it takes 2 years from the time you decide on a mission that you're going to launch before you actually launch, we knew darn well that for 2 years we wouldn't have contracts. Our fault, it's what happened. Last year we came through the governor's office and asked for $8 million. it takes 2 years to get a contract. So last year is the first $8 million. This year is the second $8 million because we don't have a launch this year either. But next year we're going to start going down because we are aggressively doing business development. As you'll learn when we do our briefing, we are actively working with the Space and Missile Defense Command. It's a U.S. Army command. We are almost to the point of signing a contract for a launch in 2014 for a missile out of a rocket out of Kodiak. We are also working with Lockheed Martin, who in the past has told you they've selected Kodiak as their launch site, and they're fairly close to completing the contract work to also do another small launch out of Kodiak in late 2014. So we do believe as we come forward with our budget that in the fall of calendar year 2014, which will be your next fiscal year, 2015, we'll be able to start bringing ourselves down on general funds because we're going to be generating contract work that you expect from us. And we're also working with the Air Force and other agencies so that in future years we think we'll get up to 3 to 4 launches a year. So as we increase the revenues from launches, we'll be reducing the request for state government. So our teams worked very diligently to kind of look at what those opportunities are for funding for launches from revenues to what we're going to require from the state, and we're very comfortable that we will not need $8 million next year, and we'll go down to 6. And as we get the additional launches in the following years, we'll go down to 4 and down to 2. So we are shifting from the state back to the private sector.
General Campbell, would you also speak then to the $25 million, to what is in process or progress right now in reference to a contract either with Lockheed Martin or another space agency?
Chairman Osterman, thank you. Again, Launch Pad 3, the medium lift, which is what the $25 million in the capital budget was for last year, was designed to meet a potential customer need to launch larger rockets, basically about twice the size of what we do now with small lift. We don't have that facility available today. It takes a new launch pad, new facilities. The first customer that came to talk to us in the state was Lockheed Martin. They're very strong in going back into a medium lift program called the Athena 3. They're working to sell that program now to the government and to other agencies so they have the payloads to launch. And they were aggressive last year hoping that we could start doing some construction this year. We didn't because we're being very conservative and slow. We don't want to go into spending any money or going for any financing until we really have the customer with the scheduled dates of launch. So we didn't do anything this year. Of the $25 million, we committed this year to do some environmental permitting. We're doing an environmental assessment, and we're doing some of the permitting process so that we're ready for the building and construction process. And we're doing initial design. We know what a medium lift generally looks like. We've been working with Lockheed on what their rocket requirements are going to be. And so we've spent money with an engineering firm to give us a conceptual design for a medium lift. That all total, we're going to only spend a little less than $1 million, and we're going to stop at that point until Lockheed gives us that schedule of what they plan for launch. There's another company, though, that also is doing medium lift that is very interested in Alaska. They visited us. They are currently in the process of an East Coast launch of the rocket called the Antares rocket. They need to have a West Coast location, and after their successful launch from the East Coast, which will happen this spring, early summer, we anticipate they, too, will be coming to Alaska to talk about doing medium lift out of the Kodiak Launch Complex. So that's another reason we didn't want to go fast on spending the money, because if we have two customers, we want to make sure we optimize the launch complex to meet all the customers that we're going to have there. So what we're doing is slowing down this year, looking for the customers to bring us the agreements and the schedules, and then we'll go forward with the full design and the construction starting next year.
Do you have a time commitment at all from Lockheed Martin?
Lockheed Martin, no, sir. They have to sell payload, and so that's all allowing us the time to not spend money and to watch to make sure that we have a customer that's really going to be able to launch from Kodiak.
Yeah, thank you, Rep. Nigger. I just wanted to make sure you had a full picture there.
Oh, no, and to keep filling it in, sorry, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but you have a potential customer from the government, a potential customer from Lockheed, but you don't actually have any known customers, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I have a customer from the federal government that's going to launch in August of 2014.
Okay.
And I have, through a process that the government uses on selecting launch operators, I have Kodiak identified with both Lockheed and Orbital Sciences for small lift launch missions by the Air Force between the period of 2013 and 2017. I don't have the missions scheduled yet for those, so I can't tell you when they are. But that contract has also been awarded. It's a $1 billion contract from the Air Force to those companies. And they'll be selecting missions that both Lockheed and Orbital will be using, and Kodiak will be where they launch from. The difference between us and a federal agency is we really are working in the private sector with private companies like Lockheed and Orbital and Northrop Grumman and Aerojet and others on it's a multi-agency plan. We are the launch service providers. Lockheed, Orbital, Aerojet are the rocket builders. There's a satellite builder, and then there's a customer, whether it's a private sector customer or the government. It has to, the whole thing has to start with either the private sector investor or the government that they have a satellite that they want to put in space. Then it cascades down to the rocket, then get to the location. So we go by, as I'm talking with the Air Force, what is their overall program? They have a $1 billion program. They're going to launch small and medium in that five-year period. They have selected Lockheed and Orbital, and Lockheed and Orbital have selected Kodiak as their launch site. So I can tell you that's real. What I can't tell you is which mission at what time. But I can tell you it's real, the contract that Orbital and Lockheed have for launches with the government that will come from Kodiak.
Captain Santa Cara.
We've spent $8 million for the last 2 years with no launches. I don't mean that facetiously. That has occurred. Can you give me the anticipated revenue for the net revenue for the one government launch in 2014 and what you expect out of these Lockheed launches? Are we still, and then are we still going to be subsidizing the corporation at that point?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, Representative Guerra, excellent question, because that's what I'm not being effective in painting the picture right, because you're asking the question I'm trying to describe. We have no launches in this year, and that's why we're asking for the $8 million, because that's really what it takes to operate and sustain the Kodiak Launch Complex in Alaska Aerospace. And I've admitted that's because we didn't do right in our business development to get other business when MDA left. We know this gap is here. It's the same story I told you last year. What I'm now telling you is, though, we are building launches. We got that 2014 launch, and I think last year we said that when we get to four launches a year, we will be generating enough revenue so we shouldn't need any operation and sustainment money from the state. So we're targeting that, and you'll see a slide we're building for our subcommittee meeting on the February 18th, which actually shows that. It puts the line at four launches, and then shows you in a bar graph kind of by year what we're looking at. And the dark part of the line says, here's what we're pretty sure about, and the light side says, this is what we're tracking. But you can pin it down that it takes $8 million a year to operate, and generally it's four launches a year to get that $8 million. We charge around $4 million for a small launch, and around $6 million will be charged for a medium launch, and that deviates based on what the needs of the mission are. But around that figure, of that, so if you take four launches at $4 million each, that's $16 million. Half of the cost that we generate there is applied to contractors and services we have to buy. The other half is applied back to our workforce and what we do. So we think four launches a year gets us break even with no request from the state for any funding.
Thanks.
Representative Munoz, to follow by Representative Kawasaki.
What are the advantages for a company like Lockheed to launch out of Kodiak versus another place in the lower 48?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, Craig Campbell again. Kodiak has let me go back to the basics of the United States. We have East Coast and West Coast launches. The United States only launches over water. If you launch from the East Coast, you go around the globe the equatorial way. So it's an equatorial orbit, and that's where most of the launches are. It's about 60% of where our orbits are around the equator. We don't do that from Kodiak, so we don't compete with the East Coast at all. On the West Coast, it's polar launches. Those go from around the poles, north to south, south to north, whatever. And so our only competitor there is Vandenberg Air Force Base. So you look at it and say, we are designed for polar launches, and our only competitor is a U.S. Air Force Base down in California, a U.S. Air Force Base that is a federally controlled range by the military that has high cost of operations. So the advantage we have at Kodiak is lower cost of operations plus we own the range. And what that It's like airspace for air traffic control. Who controls the aircraft is going to determine the priority of who launches. So at Vandenberg, where it's owned by the Air Force, the federal government will control the launch schedule. So if a commercial company comes in and says, I need to launch X date, but the government has a priority mission, they have to launch on that same X date, the priority will go to the government and the commercial side will not be able to launch them. They'll have to launch it another time. When you come to Kodiak, you sign a contract with us for what your launch date is. I don't care whether you're government or private or whoever you are. You now own the range for that time frame. And every other customer coming has to work around that to their time frame. So it gives, especially on the commercial side, great flexibility and assurance that when they've committed to the launch at Kodiak, they'll get that launch at that time frame. Much more flexibility for the customer than they have at Vandenberg.
And then a follow-up to that, will the companies that you're working with, will they locate any permanent employees into the Kodiak area to support the missions?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, in fact, yes, is the short answer, and it probably depends on the company you're talking about, but Lockheed Martin made a commitment last year that they don't want to just launch rockets from Alaska. They want to develop more of an aerospace infrastructure. And a little bit of history, we actually, from Alaska Aerospace, teamed with Lockheed Martin on a contract for Fort Greely a couple of years ago, and at that time, Lockheed's plan was to relocate about 150 people up to Alaska full-time and move into the Delta Fairbanks area. We didn't win that contract, but Lockheed never lost that commitment. And so as they came forward with this plan to launch rockets, they've made a commitment that they want to develop some form of center of excellence in aerospace in Alaska, which could include some light manufacturing, could include some teaming with the university to increase our aerospace training capabilities, a little bit of workforce development training, which you design stuff more for the aerospace industry. In fact, in November of last year, Lockheed held a suppliers conference in Anchorage, and they asked suppliers and manufacturers of Alaska businesses to come spend time with them so that they could tell Alaska what they think their requirements would be in Alaska, and then start mentoring and teaming with companies to start thinking about what could you do to support Lockheed products from the Alaska base as opposed to from Denver, Utah, Florida, or other places. So I think with the companies we're talking with, we're encouraging that it's not just, unless it's a one-time deal like SMDC, if you're a company that wants to do investment up here and we're going to build stuff for you and we're going to be launching a long-term program with you, what else is there that will increase aerospace employment in the state of Alaska? And I'll tell you on the record, Lockheed's been very forthright in wanting to do that. And if we get to the point of signing that contract, you'll see more than just a rocket launch in Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more question. Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, just briefly, I just wanted to say that I stand correct. I actually do see the decline in UGF money passed in the next couple of years. And I see the contracts line in the 10-year look forward, but after 2018, there's nothing, so it just gives us pause to think. I also just wanted to follow up and ask a question on the polar orbiting launch pads. Do we compete internationally? Are there other international venues that are going to be competitive?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, you don't just ask simple questions. That one's a good question, because that's the problem of the U.S. system today. The United States has priced ourselves out of the market commercially in many cases. So most of your truly commercial launches are being launched from French Guiana, from Russia. And U.S. companies that build satellites will buy their rocket launch services overseas because it's cheaper. What Kodiak is providing, and that's what Lockheed and I think Orbital Sciences are very interested in, is they can start lowering the cost of launch and making their prices more competitive to attract more of the U.S. commercial market back to the U.S.
Thank you.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you, gentlemen, for presenting. We'll see you guys in subcommittee in February.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick announcement that tomorrow, same time, 1:30, we'll start. We'll have two overviews, Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the Department of Law. Anything else brought for the committee before we adjourn? Seeing none, we're done.